This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 201, was recorded January 9th, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices is brought to you by Top Traders Unplugged, a podcast dedicated to quant and rules-based investing, helping investors overcome behavioral biases. With the gold market heating up, we're going to kick off 2020 with a precious metals mining shares special. Now, we've been swamped with requests to get natural resources investing guru Marin Katusa back on the program. So Marin will be joining me as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss how Marin used deal structure edge as opposed to price outlook edge to achieve better than a 90, yes, you heard that right, 90% gain in his newsletter's model portfolio of gold mining stocks in calendar year 2019. Then we'll discuss the pros and cons of private placements, which are only available to accredited investors as a tool for playing the precious metals market. Finally, we'll discuss what caused Marin, whose entire business career has always focused on natural resource companies, to organize the financing of a cloud computing startup. Be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview when Patrick and I will discuss parabolic price moves in both Apple and Tesla and what they mean in terms of interpreting where we stand. Is this a market top? Are we getting that blow off, or is this just part of the ride?
And I'm Patrick Serezna now. Eric, that S&P 500, fresh new high, blew everything off in terms of the news from Iran. What's your take on all of this?
Well, I think the important signal here is as soon as the Iran situation de-escalated, and let's be clear, I don't think the Iran situation is over by any means, but as soon as President Trump did his little de-escalation press conference, we're zooming off to all-time highs. That says to me that that downside dislocation that we saw in prices over the last several days was entirely about Iran. As soon as the market thinks Iran is over and done with, market goes straight up and we erase all of those losses. Now, I don't think Iran is over and done with. We'll come back to more on that subject when we get to crude oil in a few minutes. The point is, I think you've got to really ask yourself, okay, where do we stand? There's people who have theories that, okay, this is year-end dynamics leading into blow-off top. In the next couple of weeks, we're going to see the move up to that final parabolic blow-off. That's it, the end of the bull market. It's all over. Forget about it. It's all downhill from here. I want to get your take on that, Patrick, and we should probably go into more detail in our post-game segment about some of these moves in stocks like Apple and Tesla. But the way I'm looking at it is, hey, the whole story since 2009 has been central bank liquidity. All indications are that we should expect more, not less, central bank liquidity. You know, the Fed is in easing mode. So I think the game changer is eventually when that money gets used for other things besides buying bonds on the open market, but we're not there yet. When the music eventually stops, it's going to be really ugly. So I think if you're going to play the upside, you definitely want to play it with options, not with outright longs. But I want to ask you, Patrick, in terms of the levels that you're watching, do you think we're approaching a top here? What are you looking at, and what levels do you think are critical?
Well, my spidey senses, I'm overly bearish all the time, so that's always a problem, just like you. But the measured moves actually still suggest that an upside move toward 3,300 or 3,375 still can happen. But, you know, I have some charts we can talk about in the post game on that, and we can assess what the short-term upside is on the S&P. But let's move on to the dollar index, because it looked like that 97 break was opening a floodgate for selling, and here we are back toward 97. 50 and undoing a lot of the selling we saw over the last 2 weeks. What's your take on the dollar?
Well, on one hand, yes, it's great if you're dollar bullish to see that there is a very healthy rebound that's in play here. But if we look at the high in the dollar index on October 1st, and then the subsequent high on November 29th, you draw a trend line through those. We're still below it even here. We got to get above 97.50. So as far as the trend that we're seeing, it doesn't really give us an indication that we've broken to the upside of what could be a new downsloping trend channel until we get a daily close above 97.50 on the March contract, and we're definitely not there yet. So I do think long-term, I still am very much of the Jeff Snyder view that the dollar liquidity squeeze has the potential to drive the dollar much higher. But it ain't playing out in markets today, and until we see a change in this trend, the chart's telling me that for now, at least the intermediate-term trend is down.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil, because that pop and drop on the missiles flying was unbelievable. I mean, we're under $60 right now. What's your take on all of this?
Well, the big picture as I see it is this. The oil market was overdone to the upside before the Iran news came out in the first place. There were a lot of signs of fatigue and exhaustion in the market. We were seeing things like one of them was the first time that the Iran news came out, the F-15 strikes over the weekend. There was no gap up open whatsoever on crude oil futures. We saw a inventory report that should have been very bullish, and really there was no market reaction to it. These are all signs that the market was tired. It had already gone too far to the upside. It really looked like it wanted to roll over and correct downward. But then we had the escalation of the Iran situation. And obviously, you know, you get missiles flying and so forth. There is no limit to how much price upside can occur in the oil market when you have a geopolitical event that people at least fear could lead to some kind of regional war. The thing is, I think the market basically freaked the heck out on, oh my gosh, missiles flying, rockets, war, panic buy oil. Then the calmer voices in the oil market started saying, guys, wait a minute. There's really no reason to expect a supply disruption here. Iranian-produced oil is already off the legal market. It's maybe still there on the black market. Really, if you look at the usual fears of how this might escalate into a regional conflict that could involve other countries, it's pretty darn clear that other countries don't want that to happen. The really big one that everybody keeps throwing out is, if Iran permanently closes the Straits of Hormuz, oil could go to $150. Well, that's true, but it's like saying if I were to win the Miss America pageant, we might have to shut down the Macro Voices podcast. It's really unlikely that I'm going to win the Miss America pageant, but probably more likely than Iran being able to close the Straits of Hormuz and keep them closed. They could certainly do something to close the straits. The U.S. would reopen it very, very soon thereafter. There might have to be a little military conflict to get that done, but Iran doesn't have any ability to forcibly keep the Straits of Hormuz closed indefinitely. So I really don't think that there's really that much oil supply disruption danger here. But anytime you have a war escalation in the Middle East, people freak out, oil gets panic bid, anything could happen. If there's a further escalation where U.S. soldiers get killed in a missile attack, and that means there could be a big escalation, hey, $80 plus WTI is entirely possible. But my contention is when that geopolitical tension eventually blows over and this military conflict with Iran thing is done and over with, I think the market is already too high here, and it's got a long way to correct to the downside to get back to its fair value independent of these geopolitical tensions.
How did the inventory numbers come in for oil?
Patrick, we've had two inventory reports since we last spoke to you, because, of course, our last show was produced just before the New Year's holiday. Right after New Year's, Friday of last week, massive, massive, massive drawdown, super bullish indication that we got last week. But this week, what we saw was builds across the board, and particularly in finished products, massive builds. Crude oil building 1.2 million barrels. Gasoline building an utterly massive, 9.1 million barrels. Distillates building 5.3 million barrels. So you got, 16, 17 million barrels of crude and finished product build all in 1 week. The thing to keep in mind is, first of all, that end of year, whether it's the last week of the year or the first week of the year, the numbers are always suspect because there's all kinds of games going on with tax adjustments and end of year accounting and so forth. And remember that that final inventory report of 2019 was a great big draw. So that kind of offsets at least part of this big build. Cushing, Oklahoma was the only drawdown on the board this week, 821,000 barrels. Not a massive drawdown like the ones we've seen in recent weeks. Probably the pipeline issues still affecting Cushing. But we need to keep an eye on that because Cushing really is getting drawn down pretty significantly. U.S. production holding 12.9 million barrels. That's unchanged, maintaining a record that was set just a few weeks ago. Imports 6.7 million barrels, exports 3.1 million barrels. Now, the tape action this week was down as soon as there was confirmation that no U.S. soldiers were killed in the rocket attacks. Then we had inventory, and as much as it's true that inventory was bearish because of the big builds, really the reaction to inventory was down, but not all that hard. It wasn't until we had President Trump's press conference where he basically said, okay, things are de-escalating, looks like Iran is standing down. That's where the price really, the bottom just fell out, and it looked like, you know, they were just, the big correction is upon us. Of course, he said it looks like Iran is standing down. Since then, we've had two more rocket attacks, one on the same base that was hit 5 days ago. So it looks like this is not over, and so far there hasn't been a major re-escalation, but I wouldn't be surprised if tomorrow is another up day in price, and the reason is just nobody in their right mind wants to be short going into the weekend, knowing that military action tends to happen. So anybody who is short is likely to cover tomorrow in order to avoid being caught short over the weekend. Bottom line here, as far as I'm concerned, any amount of upside in price is possible depending on what the re-escalation of geopolitical tension looks like. But when it's all over, market needs to move lower and quite a bit lower.
All right, let's move on to gold. I know we have Marin Katusa coming on, and we're going to talk gold for even the next hour. But the interesting part is that we broke to 52-week highs. I mean, gold went almost on this big surge up. We printed temporarily above 1,600, and it seems at least things are calming down a little bit since the de-escalation. What's your take on all of this with bullion?
Well, it's a challenging picture to decode, Patrick, and the reason I say that is clearly you've got a super duper bullish breakout to new cycle highs on heavy volume, trading above $1,600 an ounce this week briefly. And normally that would be uber bullish. Meanwhile, you've got gold as priced in euros rather than dollars hitting new all-time record highs this week. So these things are normally just super bullish indications that a really big bull market is off and running. The thing is, all of it happened on a series of really big geopolitical escalations. And, you know, it looked like people were fearing World War III at one point there. So with all of that sky is falling panic moves, that's what took us up to 1600 bucks. You certainly didn't want to be buying the breakout through 1600 thinking it has to be uphill from here because you're already down $50 from that entry if you started there. There's a lot of outcomes possible. Is it just a little bit lower as we need to continue to retrace just part of this panic bid before the regular bid catches up with us and takes us higher? Or do we maybe go back down and retest that trend line at the top of the bull flag formation, which is now around 1464? Or do you get an outright reversal? And the setup for that is you've got so much overweight speculative long interest in the commitment of traders reports. That historically has been a setup for a big panic reversal as people who rushed into the market too late end up panicking and selling and starting an avalanche. That could easily take us, if it were to happen, on an outright reversal down below 1400, maybe even lower. I don't know which one of these scenarios is going to play out. The only thing that I can do is to handicap my own past performance and say, usually when I pick what I think is going to happen, the gold market has done a little better than what I was predicting. I thought we were headed down to 1420. We only got down to 1450. So each time I make a call, I end up being wrong, it seems. Now, here's what's really interesting, though. The last time that we had Marin Katusa on, he agreed with me wholeheartedly that gold likely had lower to go before eventually moving much higher. That was in his last interview about a year ago. The thing is that while I was doubting this breakout above 1350 and then waiting for a retest of 1420 before adding in significant size to my long position, Marin, during that same period, delivered a 90% return in his gold portfolio. So obviously, the question then is, okay, what am I doing wrong that he's doing right? Remember that this is a period when both of us had the same outlook. We both were bearish on gold going into this. So when I asked him in this interview, he explained that he doesn't really make his decisions based on price outlook. Now, I don't want to steal his thunder, so let's save the rest for the feature interview. He'll explain how he does do it, but needless to say, I'm humbled, but I won't get embarrassed about it. I'd much rather just admit that my way doesn't work as well as his approach. I'm going to listen to this interview myself and improve my ways.
All right, well, let's move on to the 10-year treasury yield, because after a collapse in yields throughout 2019, basically since the middle of October, we've been pinned between a yield of 175 to 195, and we're right in the middle of that range at 185. Do you have any idea where? What's your bias? What do you think is going to happen here?
Well, Patrick, as you say, for the last several weeks, we've been contained really in this 175 to 195 range. Before that, we got all the way down to 150. I think we bounced up back up to just over 2%, and then we got down into this 175, 195 range. I had been leaning toward the resolution to this being lower yields just because I think the macro backdrop is still conducive to that. The thing is, we're also seeing signs of inflation picking up, and that would be potentially the deal killer for lower bond yields. So I've really lost my conviction long term, and right now I just see it as a range-bound market. When we see a break out of that range, it'll be interesting to see which way it goes. If I had to flip a coin, I would still say I think that a lower yield resolution is more likely, but I'm not willing to bet on that right now.
This week's feature interview guest is natural resource investing guru Marin Katusa. Now, Eric, why did we invite Marin for our first show of the new decade?
Well, Patrick, I've been saying for years that gold will be the asset to own in the 2020s. So with the 2020s now upon us, I thought the first interview of the new decade should be how to play the gold market, how to invest in the gold market. And this will not be the only interview on that topic. We're planning to bring you more of the best names in gold and precious metals investing in coming weeks and months. But I wanted to start with Marin because he's pretty much known as the go-to guy for financing private placements. That is, for accredited investors, the ability to get in before the IPO on some of these gold mining stocks. There are other people like Rick Rule, who's very active in that space. Look forward to getting Rick back on the program sometime this year as well. I wanted to start with Marin, though, because we were in such perfect agreement a year ago. We both had a bearish outlook on the metal, and he's produced phenomenal returns of 90% in 2019, despite having started the year being wrong, as I was, with respect to his directional outlook for the market. So, my return was lower than 90% on my gold holdings. Let's find out what he's doing right that I'm doing wrong and how we can all benefit. And again, we're looking forward to bringing you more rock stars of precious metals investing as 2020 continues. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. In the past, the founder and host, Niels Kastrup Larsen, has provided Macro Voices listeners with some really good resources. But I think you'll agree with me that this time, he's really outdone himself with a brand new third edition to his Ultimate Guide to Systematic Trading books. Now, this latest edition isn't limited to just quant trading books. It's actually a comprehensive guide to many of the best investing books ever written. And right now, Macro Voices listeners can get a free copy of this excellent guide to all the best investing books by going to toptradersunplugged.com/macro guide. And if you haven't heard it yet, be sure to listen to my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup Larsen on trend following. The download link is in your research roundup email. Check out toptradersunplugged.com today. You'll be glad you did.
Eric's interview with Marin Katusa is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Katusa Research founder Marin Katusa. Needless to say, the gold market is really, really heating up, folks. And I don't mind admitting on the air that I was wrong at the end of last year. I really thought we would get down to probably 1420 or so before eventually this market really took off, which I've always expected that it would. And sure enough, true to form, gold has broken out of its bull flag formation a lot sooner than I expected it to. And it looks like we're off to the races. Marin, let's start with the big picture on gold and where we stand with gold. What do you see coming? And particularly, you know, right now we got a lot of geopolitical risk with Iran and everything else going on. You know, is it possible that this breakout is a false alarm and we really are still headed back down to 1400 or lower?
Very possible. Eric, you nail it on the head. This is extreme volatility. Nobody knows which way it's going. If you look at the shorts, we're at, you know, if you look at some of the charts, the COTs, different type of charts, we're at all-time extremes. And we're talking about all time, like 30 years, where, you know, the shorts are piling on, the retail's piling up. This can really go, and it's one tweet away from really going which way or another. How I've been positioned ourselves is focus on the best companies that are economic sub 1100. Now, could gold go back to 1200? I hope it does. Remember, I'm a long-term player here. I would love it if gold went. I doubt it. But could it go to 1460 or, like you said, 1420? It could over a six-month period. But then, like we saw now, something could happen and it sparks up. Do I think the sub-$1,000 gold days are behind us? I think something extreme would have to happen to see that. But I think we're going to be in a very volatile 1400 to 1650 market here for the next 12, 18 months.
Now, how are you guys navigating this? Because I know that you and I both thought a year ago that gold probably had lower to go before this was over. And unfortunately, we were both proven wrong. Have you guys stayed out of the gold side of this market? I know you've been doing uranium deals and other stuff. Or are you still investing in gold? Not recently, but you know, back when we both thought gold was headed down. And how do you manage that dichotomy, if you will, between a market view and at the same time wanting to be true to a longer term strategy?
So I have to use lower gold numbers for my economics. I can't be using spot market prices because that's just not the way economics work when you start applying discounts and all that. So first off, I'm one of the largest financiers in the gold space, not just in the juniors, but across the world. So that's the first thing. So even though I say, hey, expect lower prices, we have the top performing index in the industry. We're also one of the largest financiers in the industry. So some of the biggest names that you and I have talked about on your podcast here, like Equinox with Ross Beaty, we were the largest investors into that company other than Ross Beaty and Mubadala. I am myself a top 10 shareholder in the company personally. My subscribers get into it at the same price and same time as myself, whether it was Nevsun, Pan American, B2 Gold. These are all multi-billion dollar market cap companies. These aren't some crappy junior that trades by appointment, that has some moose pasture somewhere with a hope and a dream and a geologist with a box of crayons. These are producing companies of precious metals. And if you use a gold equivalent number, it has to be economic under 1100. And that's where I've positioned ourselves in it. And some of the companies we've talked about are up over 100% year to date. And these are big moves on multi-billion dollar market caps. Now, regardless of if gold goes to 1450, pretend, let's say it drops 125 bucks from where it's at today, the companies that we're positioned in are still cash machine generators because of the projects that they have And, you know, let's take Equinox. In 3 years, it went from zero production to next year, it'll be a 1 million ounce gold producer, which will make it the 17th largest gold producer in the world. That's public and private companies. And that started in my office 3 years ago. So that's never happened before as a company to go from zero to a million in 3 years. And that's because you back people like Ross Beattie, who's a very close friend of mine. We had a coffee yesterday morning and he's just excited. He's all so focused on this. So stick with the best people, Eric, with best projects. And, you know, early on in my career, I want to talk about the political risk, because our game is so risky as it is. So many, mining is so complicated. Why make it more complicated in jurisdictions that are a great story for a newsletter writer to jump off and go into the jungle and find, you know, the reality of it is that's not how you make a big score. Believe it or not, a lot of the big scores are right in front of you, projects in the US. For example, Eric, if you look at the discount rates that the analysts use for places that I call AK-47 places, whether it's in the Congo or other parts of Africa or South America or even Russia, it's the same discount rate that they're applying in the Great Basin in Nevada or Idaho or Utah. Does that make sense to you, Eric? It doesn't to me. So if these projects are discounted already because people aren't paying attention to them if they're producing in the US, and on top of that, they're being valued at the same discount rate to something in the Congo, I think I have an advantage to focus on politically stable jurisdictions that have a respect for the rule of law. So that's kind of my game plan. I'm staying away from sticky jurisdictions, sticking to solid management teams, skin in the game. And because the gold market has been so down, like for example, gold's touching what, 1570 and change, but the gold equities are down. So there's a lot of profit taking in here. So the market is telling you that the equity holders are taking profits and expecting gold to pull back. So, you know, you might want to listen to that. And if you're in some positions that you're not truly passionate about or really strong conviction, to me, cash is still king. And you can't buy things on a major discount if you don't have cash, because you don't want to be selling something when there's blood in the streets. You want to be a predator, a financial predator, and taking advantage of it.
Marin, I know that the gold deal that a lot of our listeners followed you into was Nevsun, and I think it was your first time we interviewed you. I think you either mentioned that in the interview or it was in your newsletter at that time. I just want to hold you accountable to that. How did our listeners and others that invested with you in Nevsun do in that investment?
So Nevsun was both in my newsletter and we mentioned it at the time. You're like, what's one of your strongest convictions on your podcast? So within a couple of weeks, your listeners were up well over 50%. And then about 6 months later, it was well over 100% gain if they stuck around. I don't know what your guys did, but in our portfolio, it was a massive win for myself personally and in our newsletter. And there's a perfect example of what I'm talking about. So many people thought, Serbia, you know, and I have to explain, I hold a passport in Croatia. If you understand the history between Croatians and Serbs, they're not really the most peaceful history. And it wasn't a big deal. This is a place that I could take my daughters to. I visited many, many times. In fact, the geologist who discovered it, the deposit of Timok, the team, was led by Miles Thompson, who was a personal friend of mine. So I was a major financier early. So it sounds like a quick, wow, this Marin guy came on the podcast and within, you know, a few weeks, I made 50%. That was a story that, you know, I was a big backer in 2008 and 2010 and 2011. You have to have a longer term vision, but now the Nevsun was a big score where if you can make a couple of 100% over a few years, that's the way you want to play it. World-class assets in a country that is misunderstood like Serbia, which I don't feel is at all a risky place. Yes, there was a war there 25 years ago, but it's very different now. And that's part of the boots on the ground. It's why I visited over 100 countries. You got to put your time into due diligence. But that's the market where, you know, we've just locked in another huge gain on Pan American Silver. People don't realize that it produces over 500,000 ounces of gold a year. Even though its name is Pan American Silver, it is the world's second largest silver producer. But to lock in a 70% gain in less than 5 months on a multi-billion dollar company, that's some very strategic thinking. The way we did it, Eric, and I want to explain my strategy. I'm not like your typical newsletter where I say, this month we're going to buy this and this month we're... No, that's not my style. I say, look, I just visited these projects. Here's the whole report, 20-page report. Here's the video of me at site. But look, I really like this company, but I think if there's more market volatility, we could pick it up. And on Pan American, we had to wait, I think it was about 4 or 5 months. I call it alligator investing. You just sit back like an alligator. And then when the price came to us, we gobbled it up in a big fashion, Eric. And that was a big score for us because, you know, to make a 70% gain in less than 6 months on a big cap, to me, on a risk-adjusted basis, is better than making 3 or 4 times your money on a risky junior. So because of the liquidity factor, the stability of the production, the free cash flow, the yield, and all these different factors, like Pan American has no debt on their balance sheet. So these are the type of things that I positioned ourselves into this market. And if you are going to play a junior, this is anyone listening to this now, you know, I'm not here to lecture or dictate, but I am one of the largest financiers in this game. And I know pretty much everyone in the business. Stick to management team whose cost base is the same as what you're getting it. Look at the structure of these financings and also look at the liquidity. You know, it's easy to buy into these juniors. It's kind of like the Hotel California song. You can check in, but how are you going to check out? How do you sell this? So that's a key factor. So be very careful in which juniors you speculate in.
Marin, you just mentioned Nevsun and Pan American Silver, which clearly you hit some real home runs there. But I think it's important to not just focus on where the big wins were. Now, in this world that we live in, where it seems like active management has become passe and everybody just believes in index funds, a lot of people would say, look, you might have hit a couple of really big home runs with a couple of plays there. But over the long haul, the research, the academics say you're better off to just go with an index and not try to pick individual stocks. And so by that logic, you know, our listeners would be better off taking GDX, which is the gold miners ETF, and GDXJ, which is the junior gold miners ETF, figure out some balance point between those two in terms of ratios for how much junior exposure you've got. You got two positions. You don't have to read a newsletter or do any more work. And there's incredible liquidity in those ETFs. So it's really, really easy, as you said, to get out of the Hotel California anytime you want. You're the guy who says no to that. You're rolling your eyes saying you're just leaving money on the table. Can we quantify that? If we take the approach that you take of individual stock investing, what you've recommended in your newsletter, and compare that to the performance, let's say, in the last year of GDX and GDXJ, how do the numbers stack up?
Look, Joe Foster, who runs VanEck, we're co-investors on deals. Sometimes we're on the opposite side of a deal. Sometimes we're partners in a deal. They're doing a good job. And for many people, Eric, I think investing in the GDX or GDXJ is the right thing. If you don't, it's kind of like there's no point of owning a membership to a gym if you're not going to go, right? And that's the way to look at a GDXJ and GDX, the majors. If you just want a small percentage of exposure to gold and you're going, okay, I'll go 2/3 major and I don't want to think about gold for the next 5 years, invest in them. That's the way to go. But if you want to educate yourself, if you want access to true wealth creation, and you know what, in all fairness to the GDX, GDXJ, they haven't done that great over the last 3 years. If you actually look at the whole chart. So over the last 12 months, they've done great. You know, gold's up 18%. The GDXJ, which is the risky one, is up 39%. The GDX, which is the more stable, is up 38%. So that right there tells you that the R between mid-tiers and juniors versus the majors isn't quite there. You're not getting paid yet to own these riskies, the higher risk juniors and mid-tiers. But my index, which is all audited, you can go and look at every single report I've ever done, is up a little over 90% during that same time. That's for the last 12 months. But let's go since the inception of my newsletter, which is July of 2016. During that time, GDX and GDXJ are kind of breaking even, and we're up a little over 42% during that time. Now, you might sit there and go, okay, well, that's only 3.5 years. Did you just start at the right time? No, I've been doing this for almost 20 years. Remember, I managed all of Doug Casey's money in his family trust. So I was the kind of key guy at the previous firm I worked at for 16 years. So how do you do this? Well, I don't believe you should own 30 stocks. So there's another mistake of, I call it the newsletter junkie world, where they're following 6 or 7 different newsletter writers, and these newsletter writers are armchair analysts, and every month they have this new great story. Well, they're in the business of storium. A lot of these analysts aren't even allowed to own their own stock. I think that's insane. Why would you ever follow someone's recommendation when they have no skin in the game themselves? So what I do is, being one of the largest financiers in the industry, is, hey, how can you get in like the insiders, like Joe Foster? Let me explain something very clear here. GDX and GDXJ, they are also a major financier to participate and are usually the leads to many financings, just like Eric Sprott, a good friend, is also. So you have to understand the index, and I look at it going, well, why not be an alligator? I don't need 30 stocks. What about just 8 to 10 stocks? And I sit like an alligator, like, for example, how we picked up B2. B2 Gold has this phenomenal world-class asset called Fekola. It truly, truly is. The definition of a world-class tier one deposit is it produces over 500,000 ounces of gold a year, has at least 5 million ounces of reserves. Remember, reserves are economic at the specific price, a slight discount to the market of the current spot price of gold. B2 has that. But I've known Clive Johnson for 15 years. In 2011, we went to the Super Bowl together and hung out for a weekend. Great guy. His management team are super smart. Now, let me explain something, though. I waited 6 months like an alligator in our publication, talked about it every month and said, just be patient. Don't chase it. Don't be like the market. So we're the opposite of an index fund. A lot of people have to realize that GDX and GDXJ, when they're trying to buy a stock, they cause the price to go up also. So you're not always getting the best price. For B2, we're up over 80% in less than 6 months owning the stock. And I haven't yet taken what I call a Catoosa-free ride, meaning taking all my principal out, because I do believe that it's going higher because of the quality of its deposit. They're just hitting great numbers and making a lot of free cash flow. So that's kind of my strategy, Eric, and that's the track record there.
Okay, hang on a second, Marin, because obviously 90% in the last year is amazing. Congratulations, first of all. But my job here is to both be skeptical and to make sure we call a spade a spade. I know a lot of what you do at Catoosa Research involves getting involved very early stage in private placements in deals which are not yet public, which means you don't have the liquidity that you would have on a GDX. So I'm assuming when you're talking about 90% return in your portfolio, that's including your private placements. What if we looked only at those things that are apples to apples, actually listed securities that I can sell, on a moment's notice with a click of a mouse?
So let me really explain this. What I'm talking about, all the gold stocks, the index, to make an apple to apple comparison, private placements. I know it sounds like it invests in private companies. We've only done one of over 15 private placements that was actually a private company. Then it got listed. That wasn't even a gold company. That 90% does include two private placements of a publicly traded gold company. Ironically, if I take those two private placements out, my index would actually be over 100% gains. The private placement was at a bit higher price, so it pulled back my index gains. So of just the publicly listed that you can sit in a car and buy on your discount broker, our gains would be over 100% over the same time that GDX and GDXJ made 38 and 39% gains. So, but let me explain what the phrase private placements, what that actually means is almost 99% of all my private placements are of publicly listed traded companies. Even though it's called private, the stocks aren't private, they're listed. The reason why it's called private placement is a legal term, or sometimes they call it special warrants. It's a way to get your full allocation in a transaction with a company or a broker who's financing it. And then you don't chase the stock in the market. So for example, on Equinox, where all my subscribers got in and we got a full 5-year listed tradable warrant, you tell the company, hey, I'm Marin, I want a couple $100,000 of this. And then they fill your slot. You don't have to go into the market and buy. Then you get a certificate. That's a private certificate. You take that to your broker, and then you get free trading shares after the restriction period of 4 months is over. All private placements have a 4-month hold unless there's a short form financing associated, which then becomes free trading, which we've also participated in. So did I answer your question there, Eric?
Well, let me make sure I understand this. If my choice is I can either invest in GDX to just get index exposure without thinking about it to gold miners. The approach with you, you're saying, even if I don't want to get involved in illiquid private placements, if I just want to buy stocks that I can buy at the click of a mouse with any discount broker, there's a symbol for it. You can buy it on an exchange and you own it in your brokerage account and you're done. How does that structure? That's a list of stocks that appears in the KRO newsletter each month?
Correct.
Okay, and that changes presumably.
Yeah, exactly. So for example, let's say BTO, that's a ticker symbol, B2 Gold. We're up over 85% on it, and now it's a hold. So I'm telling people, I'm personally not buying at this price. So we're holding, but I'm not selling either because I think it's going to go higher. But when it was a buy, I said, just stay back, relax, buy it under 280 Canadian. And, you know, a lot of time it was trading a 302, 305. And for a couple of months, people get frustrated going, well, Maren, I subscribe to your service because I want to buy now. Well, you need patience. Like, you can't just go and, you know, it's not like you're at the grocery store and you need to feed yourself today. Speculating and investing in these stocks, you have to be patient and wait for the market to come. And then for about 35 days, you could have bought all the stock you wanted at our buy price. Now it's at $5.30. So that's the style of my newsletter. We have a whole list of current active actionable buy stocks. Then there's the ones that we've been filled on, and then they're in the holds. Then I have my watch list, for example. Here, Eric, I'll give you one that I think is going to be bought out, Pretium. It's run by a guy that I got to know really well, Bob Quartermain. I personally think he's one of the best guys in the industry. He's a great guy. And his deposit is so high grade. They produce just under 400,000 ounces of gold a year. So that's a good, good project. Not yet quite a world-class deposit, but it's definitely it's too big for any mid-tier company. Now, here's my speculation on it. I tried to finance this company when it was going public in 2010. I ran into Bob Quartermain at the airport. I wanted warrants. He didn't. He was able to finance without warrants. He won. No big deal. I sat along on the sidelines, and now we've been able to pick up our position, and my subscribers were up on it. And I also said, hey, if you want to be strategic, I think it's going to get bought out north of $18 Canadian. Now, if you're a major like Barrick, Barrick has tax losses from its previous acquisitions of mines that they bought, you know, 15 years ago, 10 years ago, and in their balance sheet. So Barrick now can apply those tax losses to the production if they take out a company like Pretium. So there's an advantage for a big boy like Barrick. Now, secondly, this project, it's so variable in grade. One quarter, it will be 8.8 grams per gold, which is very high grade. But the market expects it to be 10 grams. Now, the variability between, say, 9 grams and 10 grams doesn't sound that much, but it's a big difference on the financial balance sheet because this is an underground mine. That's too volatile for a one-mine mid-tier company. But for a major like Barrick, it's not a big deal. It's just a good-built mine in a politically stable jurisdiction. It's in Canada. And there's an asset that for many months, over a year, I was talking about, wrote it up, and now we just got filled on it before this big pop in gold before Christmas. And I also say, hey, for those who like to trade options, this is what I'm personally doing on the options side and how you can get a 2-for-1 bang. So I think even though the stock price, I think it's going to get bought out at about 35 to 40% premium to where it is now, if I'm right and you want to play the options, you'll get paid about 70% gains. So there's also the option angle that I talk about in the newsletter. We did a short on a natural gas company, Eric, and in less than 60 days, we locked in for all our subscribers over 150% gains on the short using options. So that's also a strategy we talk about in the newsletter for more sophisticated newsletter subscribers, but it's like an extra feature of, hey, there's this opportunity. I'm personally doing this at this price. If you like it, here's the report and you can play it.
Okay, Maren. So what we've discussed so far, you've got a list of stocks, which instead of investing in something like a GDX or GDXJ, the people who follow your newsletter are investing directly in the stocks that you recommend. That's all the public market stuff. You can do the whole thing with a discount broker, with E-Trade or TD Ameritrade or whatever you've got at a click of a mouse. Your firm also gets very heavily involved in these private placements, we call them in the United States, in Canada, I guess you call them financings. The trade-off there is, first of all, it's only available to accredited investors, but there's an advantage that you're effectively getting a liquidity premium in addition to whatever you'd otherwise be making. Explain how that works and what the appeal is. Why would somebody want to get into what, frankly, is a more complicated transaction? It doesn't give you instantaneous liquidity. You've got to wait at least months, sometimes years, before you're able to sell out of an investment like that. Why would I even consider something like that?
So let's start with the private placement. So I've only done one private placement of a company that wasn't public. That was Uranium Royalty Corp. It's now public and listed and trading. So people can, you know, at that point. But there was that was a little over about 16-month hold for that one. That was the longest hold period we've ever had in the newsletter. Usually speaking, it's a 4-month hold for private placements on the Canadian listed markets. Now, why do you want to do this? So first off is you get, generally speaking, the financiers are called underwriters because if the stock's, say, at $1.20, the maximum discount you can get is a 20%. So they'll discount the price to attract capital. So that's number one. Number two, because the resource market has been so underperforming over the last decade, you're able to get things like a half warrant or a warrant. So what I ended up doing was creating something that Rick Rule calls the Catoosa warrant, which is a full 5-year listed and tradable warrant. So we've done it on Equinox. We did it on Northern Dynasty, which you and I have never talked about, but it was at over a 10, it was 18 times your money. And that's not included in our index there for the last 12 months. And you get these listed tradable warrants. We've done it on Uranium Royalty Corp. So all these aspects. So if you look at the discount to the market plus the kicker of the warrant, it's just a better way to speculate in a risky market. Now, yes, you have to be accredited. And number two, it takes more effort. You actually have to pick up the phone and either phone your broker to get the stock for you, or you call the management team yourself. But all the good things in life aren't easy, and it's not that hard. Initially, I'm sure people would be intimidated by calling a company and going, oh my God, I'm talking to this company. Well, remember, these are just management guys. They're just normal people, and they actually love talking to the subscribers because they get a sense of what the subscribers want. Number two, filling out the forms is a pain in the ass, but you know, it's like filling out any other form. You do it, you send it in, and then you wire your funds. So yes, it takes a little bit of more effort than buying in the open market, but it's how you supercharge your gains, Eric.
Okay, Maren, hang on a second, because on these financings, I know it is regular and normal in the industry for brokers like yourself. You're raising lots and lots of money for these companies that you're organizing these financings for. It is normal for brokers to get paid commissions, kickbacks, essentially. You go to huge lengths in your newsletter to, you know, you put it in writing all over the place. I don't get paid anything for this. Help me as a skeptic here. As an investor, my job is to be skeptical. Why should I believe that you would, in a business where it's normal and usual for people in your position to get a commission from these companies, why would you be foregoing that and not getting paid anything? And why would you be, as you're putting it, on the same terms as your newsletter subscribers when you don't have to be? You can get a better deal as a broker. What would motivate you to do it this way?
A few things. First off, I work for my subscribers and they pay me a lot of money, and I've got thousands of subscribers to find the best private placement deals. Now, the business usually was an investment banker gets hired by the company to fly around to all the funds like myself and all the big guys like Eric Sprott, and you talked about the GDXJ, to pitch the deal. And it was those terms. Well, it was a price maker market. When the market got down, I realized that, hey, I can actually take advantage of this market, but I can't finance these companies all by myself. So I created this newsletter and this huge following, and then I could go to these companies, cut out the banker, cut out the broker, and then we get better terms. For example, to get Equinox today is the 25th largest producer of gold in the world. Ross Beaty has invested over $200 million of his own money into the deal. He's the chairman, okay? For me to be able to get a full 5-year listed tradable warrant is unheard of in the business. But why? We brought over $160 million to that deal, Eric. I took zero, not a fucking penny out of that deal. And I've had the regulators look into it because they can't believe it. No one's done this before. Ross Beatty's like, nope, we never paid Marin a penny. But that's how I'm able to get better terms, because the finder's fee that a regular broker would get on $160 million would work out to be over north of $10 million, Eric. And I'm saying, screw that. Let it go to the in the ground and let's us, the investors, get that better terms. And that's how I'm able to get the full 5-year listed tradable warrant. And I'm doing it right now on another deal. Now, I'm not trying to make enemies with the brokers. I'm trying to coexist with them. But if a broker didn't bring a deal to me and he didn't do the research and he didn't do all the stuff that I'm doing, why should they get paid for it? Now, if a broker brings me a deal and he's done all the work, yeah, I have no problem with them taking a finder's fee. But what I've realized is almost all of the deals I've done, I've generated the ideas and research from my 20 years of relationships in the business. That's how it's done. And that's just what it is. And it's kind of like a publish and perish. A lot of people go, well, why the hell with your financial net worth are you even bother writing a newsletter? Well, it's kind of like a university professor. You publish or you perish. By writing all the time, I'm able to attract companies. And literally on Christmas Eve, I was in my office with my team. We're working. I got a phone call from a guy who needed a short term. He was in a jam. His company needed some cash on a really strategic advantage. I said, sure. I go, let's talk about terms. He said, okay, I'll meet you on the 30th at your office. We agreed to the terms. And it's by them knowing that I'm able to move quickly. I'm not some huge bank that takes 3 months to go through all the bureaucratic change. And I'm the lead order personally. We've done it on a few deals in here, whether it's Uranium Royalty Corp or mCloud. All of whoever in your list or my list have subscribed to are big up. Their gains are up substantially. And the market hasn't really even truly taken off. So that's kind of the strategy of why I'm doing it. And that's how I've become one of the largest financiers in the business.
So this is a power play for you. I mean, there is something for you in it, which is you walk into a CEO's office in a mining company, and there's a bunch of other brokers there, and they're each going to get their percentage, their whatever. And you just walk in and say, look, I've got enough capital with all of my subscribers behind me that I can pull down this entire deal right now. Let's make a deal, and I don't need to get paid anything. I'm going to get the advantage of negotiating better terms for yourself.
In addition,
you bring your subscribers along with you.
In addition,
and you end up
in addition to what you're saying is when gold was 16, 17, 1800 in 2010 and 11, the bankers were able to do something called bought deals where they would guarantee these companies that kind of ended in 2013 when a bunch of firms got hung, meaning they got stuck with a bought deal and then they used some legal loopholes to weasel out of a bought deal. So bought deals are very rare. And now they realize that a financing with me is always oversold, so there's no risk to the financing not being completed. For example, the financing that you and I talked about, the mCloud one, that was 3 times oversold. So just to give you an example, Eric, the 3 largest financings ever on the Canadian Junior Exchange all happened to be my financings. So this is bigger than the biggest brokers in the business combined. Because of the power of bringing accredited investors together, you know, and it's kind of like I'm like a financial warrior where why should a broker get paid for something that they're not even doing? Now, if they bring me the deal, okay, fine, I'll pay you. And that's how I create peace with the brokers. But they're not out there. Like I'm heading out to Saudi Arabia in April. They're not going out to these places to find these deals with, you know, who's going to do the next joint venture with Saudi Aramco. I'm on the road nonstop. And I do that for my subscribers and I bring my film crew and I do all that. And it's a way for us to get better deals together. And I can't emphasize this enough, Eric. My subscribers get in at the same time, at the same price, and they get to sell before I do. So like on Nevsun, they sold before I did. On Pan American, they get to sell before I did. So that's my strategy, and that's how I become, you know, a power player in the business.
And that's the way you can get away with charging full price for a newsletter. The other guys who are getting paid commissions, they've got free newsletters because they want to bring anybody along that they can. I want to come back, though, to Universal mCloud because that's one that I've been really perplexed by. Marin, your whole career, you've been Mr. Natural Resources, primarily precious metals. But when we see you do a deal like Uranium Royalty Corp, okay, you did an excellent interview on this podcast a year or so ago explaining the case for uranium. It's a natural resource. It makes sense. But mCloud is a cloud computing company. How does a natural resource guy get to doing a private placement for a cloud computing company? What's the connection here?
Well, first, they're going to do over $80 million in revenue, and a lot of that comes from the oil patch. As the market got tough in the sector, you know, sub-$70 oil, people have to innovate. And, you know, I was the first guy, I was on the founder of a company called Copper Mountain, third largest copper producer in Canada. Our advantage was I kept pushing the envelope. And I was the one, Jimmy and I were spearheaded what we called we were the first smart grid mine in Canada. using, you know, an electronic dispatch system where little tweaks, like, you know, for example, do you know how what standard way for a truck operator in an open pit mine to get the signal? He doesn't know if it's ore or waste. The shovel operator honks once for ore and honks twice for waste to go to the dumps. Now, first of all, think about this. Is it loud? Yes. Is the guy probably listening to a podcast? Probably. You're not talking about super focused or intelligent. Like, I'm not trying to be an asshole here, but, you know, truck drivers aren't on the high end of the spectrum of, you know, skin in the game kind of factor. Well, I said, this is insane. And I got a hearing problem in one of my ears. I go, was that one or two? Because there's a blast that happened on the other side of them. There's three open pits there. And I go, was that one or two? And they're like, oh, no, that was one. And the other guy's like, no, it was two. So then I created a spreadsheet and I go, wait a second. We're like 7% off of our production. Well, what happened was we found, just like at most mines, that, you know, if a guy goes to the dumps three times in a row, what does his mind want to do naturally? Go the same route. So some of the ore was being dumped into the waste dumps and some of the waste was going to the dumps. Well, we created a dispatch system electronically that alarms the guy and the truck operator does not talk to the shovel operator anymore. It's all done electronically now. And if he's going the wrong way, the GPS unit alarms him and says, stop, and it'll shut down the truck and go the right way. Something as basic as that improved the production of 7% or the equivalent of three trucks. Well, these trucks, you're thinking, oh, what's a big deal, a pickup truck? Well, actually, these trucks cost about $4.8 million per truck. Tires go at $40,000 a pop. They go for, if you're lucky, 2,500 hours. You need six per truck. But it's not just that. You're talking about three truck drivers. Remember, the mine operates 24/7. So you need double that, six guys. On top of that, you need an extra guy in case one of them gets sick. And then you talk about the maintenance on those trucks. So you think about all the cost, you save about an extra $15 million by just putting in something that costed less than $1 million. We were the first in North America to do that. Now it's becoming common. So as I go to all these, unscheduled downtime is a killer in the resource schedule. And I looked at it as what mCloud was the intelligence of things. Everyone talks about the Internet of Things. In my mind, I always looked at it as the intelligence of things. How can I go in and quickly repair a pump? You know, people don't realize that the pumps and all these things that you take for granted, you know, are some of the biggest electrical costs. Well, if it's not running, like an HVAC system is the biggest cost for Starbucks. You think, what the fuck, an HVAC? Yeah, blowing air, or in a casino, you got to have fresh air for people. They don't want it stuffy. But these things were built 20 years ago. So now if these well heads and all these different pipes, if they're able to be monitored and properly, the intelligence is to say, hey, something's not running well here. Or if a fuse box has issues. These are all the types of things that mCloud has exposure to, and companies wanting to eliminate these unscheduled, unplanned downtime, which is the biggest killer to their bottom line. That is an intelligent thing. It's been proved out. It makes money. And look at that stock right now. You know, when we talked about it on your show, you could have bought it under $4 a share. We financed it. Very oversold. The debenture's in the money. It's trading at a huge premium. It's trading at over 20% premium in the market right now, but we're getting paid 10%. It was the first ever exchange where your unit in the debenture converts into a share and a warrant, because it's my style. And there's a financing going on right now in the company also that explains the advantage my subscribers are getting. It's a $4 financing that you get a share and a half warrant. So instead of a full warrant like we got in the debenture, you get a half warrant for 5 years at $5.40, Eric. And the stock's trading about 570, 580 right now in the market. But everyone on your show and all my subscribers, we got filled under $4 a share.
Well, wait a minute. Not everyone on our show. It was your subscribers. And our listeners had the option to subscribe. But you wouldn't tell our listeners on the air what the deal was unless they subscribed. So let's be fair on that one. I want to come back to this, though, because I am still, Maren, utterly baffled by this. If what you had just told me was, okay, we did a financing, you know, 6 months ago, and it was at $4, and what you got was the share and the half warrant, and today you could sell that share for $5.80, and you could probably sell the warrant for another 50, 60 cents. So you go from $4 to $6 in only 6 months. That would sound like a great return. But as I understand it, that's not what you're saying. You're saying you can buy more at $4 right now. You've still got the ability to do more private placements at $4, which is a share and a half warrant. And because of the liquidity rules, you're not allowed to turn around and sell it the next day. You've got to sit on it for 4 months. But if you're willing to sit on it for 4 months, what is now selling at upwards of $6, you can buy for $4 and wait 4 months and sell it. And you're taking just the market risk that it might go down between now and then.
I sent out the alert on the first Wednesday of January. So what was that? January 2nd. And our subscribers are doing exactly what you just mentioned, correct?
So, I mean, what doesn't really add up to me here, that sounds like a risk-free arbitrage. I can buy something for $4 and effectively sell it for $6 almost at the same time. You're not allowed to take those shares that you just bought and sell them. But I would think a creative trader could figure out how to hedge this. You know, you go into one account and you short the stock and you buy it in the other account and you end up taking all of your risk off and you end up with a risk-free arbitrage. Is that really true? Am I missing something there?
It's not 100% risk-free because there's always risk. The stock could blow up tomorrow or the market could all go down. But essentially, yes. And I'm the largest investor in this current financing also. Yeah, I believe the stock's going higher. So that's why I'm not buying it because, you know, the true value of the stock right now with that warrant is over $6 and you're paying $4. I'm not buying it just purely based off of that speculation or arbitrage, as you're calling it. You are correct. That's exactly what we're doing. But I think it goes a lot higher from here.
And again, just to summarize, the reason that you're in this, it is a technology company, but it's basically a technology company that solves a whole bunch of problems that companies that you have invested in are dealing with in the resource sector. The example being the guy that's banging on the truck. You've got monitors on oil wells, on mining rigs, on everything else that are basically making this whole very antiquated business model of how mining and oil production work, and they're modernizing it with Internet of Things, sensors, and so forth.
Let me give you even a better, simpler example now that I think about it. Let's take someone like Saudi Aramco. They've just done a massive IPO, okay? Floated the company. Whether it's a little bit above or below $2 trillion is irrelevant. The fact of the matter is when Chevron went in there back in the day and built up all this infrastructure, over 90% of their existing infrastructure was built before the year 2000. Now, we saw in September what happened. Now, whether it was the Iranians or whoever sent the bomb missiles in, it was down for 3 months. Well, imagine now you have real-time data. I'm talking military-grade designs in real time that you can pull up and you could shut down the pipes where it is affected to eliminate the fire. Or more importantly, know exactly where the impacted area is, because now in 20 years ago, they didn't have that all digitalized to, you know, the accuracy, what bolts, what pumps, what valves, you know, what washers. That's the act. We're talking about military grade, and the company mCloud already has that. Think about the solution to someone like Saudi Aramco that this does, or other oil wells. Like they just announced that they're opening an office in the US. Well, geez, why is the stock ripping? Well, the management are hitting all of their targets and they're aggressively expanding and they have the capital to do so. So this is a, you know, management and insiders own 43% of the company at the cost base that myself and my subscribers invested in. It fits my formula. It fits my framework. And there will be a time that we sell the stock. I just think it's going to be at a lot higher price because this story hasn't even, other than a couple of guys like you and a few other friends of mine that are interested in what I'm doing, this is a relatively unknown story.
Now, is this going to be a new thing for you, Marin? Because it seems to me like you're onto something. You took something you know a lot about, which is the natural resource investing sector, and you said, in what respects are these companies getting screwed? They're taking, you know, they're spending millions of dollars to mine ore that's hopefully full of gold out of a mine, and then they're dumping it in the trash by mistake because they didn't listen to how many times the guy honked the horn. You're taking a problem like that and you're solving it with technology. And when you, it sounds like you came across a technology company that you saw as a solution to a lot of your investment target company's problem. You said, hey, I want to get in on this. I don't want to just recommend this company to the companies I invest in. I want to be involved in owning the company that's providing this technology. You know a lot about a lot of problems that mining and natural resources face. Would you see yourself going to look for more technology companies that do other things to, I don't know, advance this space or you know, change it in a way that would allow you to profit both from improving the performance of the companies you already own and at the same time owning a piece of the company that is creating that solution?
So we have a dozen guys, analysts here at Catoosa Research. One guy just solely focuses. He's actually a former calculus student of mine. He's a brilliant, brilliant mind. His whole focus is technology. Sadly, Eric, the truth is even though I have a guy focusing on this, so many of these technologies should only be a service. Like it's a cool service, but they're so focused on just one thing that it's not something that I would invest in, but I would use their service or I'd recommend their service to a mine that I know has those issues. The difference with mCloud is it has a portfolio, or call it a suite of goods. You know, it's like the Office Windows. It has Excel, it has PowerPoint, it has Word, it has all these different factors. It's a suite of goods for the oil patch. It's such a unique story in the, what do you want to call it, the intelligence of things or the Internet of Things. It's a really unique story, and although we spent, you know, 3 years looking for this, I found only one that we've actually physically invested in. So I would love to say yes, but the reality is it's very rare.
Marin, we're almost out of time, and I wanted to focus today's conversation primarily on gold and natural resource because it's what's hot right now. But we also have quite a few Macro Voices listeners who have followed you into Uranium Royalty Corporation based on your uranium interview that you did, I think it was a year ago now. Give us a quick update. How did that IPO go? I think the IPO is now public. So is the stock trading? How did people do? I think it was you got the first batch of Macro Voices listeners on the first interview you did, got in on the private placement in URC at a dollar. Where's the stock trading now? How did the IPO do? Give us the update.
Yeah, so the stock went public and trading in the, I think it was like the second week of December, so just before Christmas. So everyone got their certs. You should, you know, if you haven't, contact the management. And I got to give credit to two guys who really stepped up big. First of all, obviously, Amir Adnani, the chairman of the company, he personally stood up and said, I'm going to invest in 10% of this personally. And then I said, well, I'm there. And there's another very good friend, mentor of mine, you know him well, Rick Rule. And the three of us said, we're so into this. We believe in it so much. And Rick personally put up also $2 million. So we each said, we're going to do this $20 million financing. That's what the amount was supposed to be, Eric. Because of the excess demand and the use of proceeds and some strategic potential that they have, it was over 3.5 times oversold, and they raised the financing or the IPO to $30 million, a little over $30 million, and it was the largest resource IPO of the year in the industry. So it's done very well. Combined right now with the warrant, it's $1.55. The shares are trading at $1.20, so the IPO was at $1.50, and you got a full 5-year listed tradable warrant that is trading right now at 35 cents. So everyone's happy. It's still early days, but I do expect some large transactions on the company in the first half of this year. So I'm very long. This is my play on uranium, just to emphasize my whole cut to kill strategy that I think Russia and Kazakhs are doing. And I don't see uranium popping big this year. Hence my whole strategy of Uranium Royalty Corp is the NAV of companies, the net asset value of a company is trading at like less than 0.2 of its NAV. So it makes no sense for these companies to dilute their equity and their shareholders at such a discount to NAV. And that's where a company like Uranium Royalty Corp, which is the cheapest royalty company out of any royalty company listed, they have all this cash, they have no debt, they have over $40 million of equity able to invest in these companies. So it's a solution for the uranium companies so they don't dilute their shareholders. And it's a great win for the royalty shareholders because they get access to the best assets in the best jurisdictions at, you know, uranium's $25 a pound right now. That's when you want to buy royalties, when the price of, you know, the equivalent of gold at $400 an ounce. That's how you win if you've got a longer term strategy. That's my strategy on Uranium Royalty Corp.
Now, obviously, the best deals were for the people that followed you in on the private placement at a dollar. But for any newer listeners that we have who may be interested in this uranium space, is URC still a buy at current market prices for people who missed all that and are just coming to this? Or is it more one of those stories where the opportunity's already kind of passed us?
No, not at all. For a royalty company, whether it's Franco, Nevada, run by Pierre Lassonde, or Randy's company, Wheaton Precious Metal, or Nolan's company, Sandstorm, it's all based on the NAV. And right now, Uranium Royalty Corp is trading at 0.9 NAV, whereas Franco, Nevada is trading at 2.3 times NAV. So Wheaton Precious is trading at over 2 times NAV. Sandstorm's trading at about 1.5 times NAV. So you have to look at the situation and go, okay, well, what's my time frame? Do I want to buy the warrants? Do you want that? You know, warrants, or think of it as a derivative to the share price. It's almost, it's an option. That's essentially what a warrant listed is. Or do you want to just sit back? And at 0.9 times NAV, that's cheap for a royalty company. Now, for myself, I participated in the dollar financing and the $1.50 financing, both in big ways. And for my subscribers, I only recommend what I'm doing myself, and that's what I tell the subscribers. So right now, we bought two tranches, the dollar and the $1.50, and now I'm just waiting. Now, if the stock, if the market pulls back and the stock goes to, say, $1.05, or maybe it doesn't, whatever, at that point, I may decide to buy more, then I'll tell my subscribers what I'm doing. Or they may do a financing on a very large transaction, and then I'll determine what I'm doing. But right now, it's a hold, and my subscribers have two of their four tranches. So Eric, the way I do all my investments is I tell people never, ever load up at the same time. It's the biggest mistake I've seen subscribers and even fund managers, when they start out, they have some capital, they're excited, and they invest all in one time in one story. Be an alligator. Take your time. So think about this for Uranium Royalty Corp. It was over a year ago that we were on your show, and I've set aside a certain amount of my capital, and I'm only half of my allocation, and it's been a year and a bit. So we have two of our four tranches filled. On Equinox, it's been 3 years, and I have three of my four tranches filled, because I take a very long-term perspective on each position. It's also important position sizing. That's why I do the tranches.
And once again, Marin, Patrick Serezna, my co-host and producer, has negotiated with your team to get our listeners a huge discount. It's $1,500 off. Again, this is not a low-end product. This is pretty much the premier newsletter in the space. In the interest of full disclosure, I should tell our listeners that I am a subscriber myself. The normal subscription price is $3,500 per year. It's discounted by $1,500 for our listeners down to $1,999. We were warned, though, by Marin's staff that they are going to rigorously enforce the 10-day time limit on this offer. And they're not trying to be a pain in the tail. The issue is simply that they have the VRIC, the Vancouver Resource Investment Conference, coming up. They're going to be charging full price there, obviously, ethically. They don't want to be giving one party a discount while someone else has to pay full price. So they have to close this deal up before VRIC starts. On that note, before we go, Marin, please tell us about VRIC itself. It's a big show. We've got Big Picture Trading. Patrick Serezna's company is exhibiting there. Patrick is speaking there. I know you're speaking there on a number of subjects. What's VRIC? When is it? And how can our listeners find out more?
So VRIC is the world's largest resource-focused investment conference for the mid-tiers and junior public companies. We had over 9,000 attendees. We take the maximum square footage of the biggest convention center in Western Canada. That's called the Vancouver Conference Center. And we bring in the best names in the business. Yourself, Patrick, did a fantastic job at the San Francisco show. He gave some great caller options that have worked out well for whoever followed. We bring, you know, my buddies, Raul, Paul from Real Vision, and Grant Williams, Brent Johnson. Rick Rule is being inducted into the Resource Hall of Fame. So for myself, that's a big personal treat, because I'm doing the actual induction speech for him. He's just a legend. And the conference is held by Cambridge House. That's my partner, Jay Martin. We run the show together. And it really is the show to go to for your audience.
I have to confess, Marin, as I'm looking through my notes here, we got a deal for our subscribers on the subscription to your newsletter that I just described. I think we intended to try to see if we could get a discount on the tickets to go to the show, which I know we had last year. And frankly, I dropped the ball. How about some kind of deal? What can we get for Macro Voices listeners to attend VRIC?
I'll tell you what, if you promise to come next year, Eric, yourself and Patrick, I'll let all your people in for free and you just use my personal family code of KATUSA100. So just my last name, KATUSA, then 100, no space, on the registration form online, and then your guys will get in for free.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you, sir, for that courtesy. We'll get in your research roundup email, folks. You'll find links both for the $1,500 off offer on the subscription to Marin's newsletter, which I do subscribe to myself. And if you're serious about investing in this space, it doesn't take very long for it to pay for itself. And then completely free attendance at VRIC with that code KATUSA100. You have to use that on a registration website. We'll have the link to that website also in your research roundup email. We need to leave it there in the interest of time. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was always great to hear from Marin KATUSA. I'm looking forward to seeing him at the VRIC in a couple of weeks. But we have some further housekeeping just to add to that interview.
Well, Patrick, that's a nice way of putting it. Of course, folks, what really Patrick's saying is I screwed up and didn't follow the instructions he emailed me in the end of the interview. I was supposed to mention that there is a 30-day, no questions asked, money-back guarantee on subscriptions to Marin's newsletter. Forgot to mention that because we were running a little bit short on time. The other thing that I meant to ask Marin about in this interview, and we ran out of time and I forgot to do it, is in your research roundup email, you'll find a link, and that link is also on our homepage at macrovoices.com in the description of today's interview. It is a link to a session at the Gold and Silver Summit in San Francisco. This is just from a couple of months ago. It's got some really big names. It was Marin KATUSA, Grant Williams, Brent Johnson, and you, Patrick, our very own Macro Voices co-host. You were also a speaker at this particular session. The reason I'm highlighting this one, folks, is in that Patrick described a collaring strategy on gold, which left a few people confused. We're going to explain that in detail in next week's postgame segment. So we encourage everybody to watch that kind of as a prerequisite before next week's show, because Patrick is going to elaborate and explain in more detail how the collaring strategy works.
And Eric, just a quick mention, you can find that in your research roundup as well as on the homepage of Macro Voices. Moving on here, what did you take away from that interview with Marin?
Well, needless to say, I think that his approach of using deal structure edge and not really trying to time his market moves based on his price outlook has clearly worked a heck of a lot better than the approach that I've taken. So I was definitely impressed with that aspect of it, but particularly what interests me, and it was interesting, you know, in this interview, Marin was a little bit loose with his language, a little bit of locker room vocabulary there, but he was also loose. In the past, he's been very, very hesitant to mention some of the names of these companies that are in his subscription newsletter. He mentioned mCloud by name, which surprised me a little bit. Now, that deal of a $4 purchase on restricted shares of something that's already trading in the open market at $5.80. So it would effectively be a big risk-free arbitrage if not for the time restriction. And we talked a little bit about this off the air. There's a risk-free arbitrage if you bought puts in order to lock in your price. The thing is, it's a small issue, doesn't have an active option chain. Still, I just think it's amazing that they're still offering accredited investors the opportunity to directly buy at $4 something that's selling at $5.80 on the open market. So that caught my attention as well. But I thought it was a great interview, and I'm really looking forward. We've gotten quite a few requests for gold-related subjects and particularly advanced precious metals subjects. So Rick Rule is one person I'd like to get back. I think Josh Crum were overdue to get on the show. So we're working on getting some of the best experts in the space for future interviews here on Macro Voices. Meanwhile, I want to move on to our post-game chart book, which is called Going Parabolic. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. Patrick, Going Parabolic, and you're sporting a new sport jacket on this picture. Are you going to be wearing that jacket while you perform the trampoline version of the Gamma Flip at VRIC in Vancouver?
No, I got a special jacket for that. We'll save it for then.
Okay.
So what I wanted to jump in here on this, it's like there's some charts that are just crazy. And we got to talk about this. And that's why I put together some charts. Well, I started here on page 2 and 3, just putting the S&P and the NASDAQ. And really what I wanted to do is just illustrate where the measured move is on the upside of these. And the S&P does measure up towards the 3,300 to the 3,375 level on the upside. So even from a technical perspective, there is still room for the S&P. I know that there's a number of analysts out there that are talking that 3,500 number, but these are some of the short-term targets that I think it can be reached and would potentially house a reversal, at least a pause in the market. For the NASDAQ, that level is around this 9,000 to 9,200. So we're already tapping into it at these levels.
Patrick, moving on to page 4, you've got a chart showing the parabolic blow-off top that occurred in Bitcoin. And I'll toot our own horn a little bit. That would be the one that we called pretty much perfectly on this program as it was happening. Here, what we see is a series of steeper and steeper price moves to the upside. Each of those trend lines keeps getting steeper, which is what we call a parabolic move. What does it mean and what does it tell you and how does it relate to the current market?
Right. So what I wanted to highlight here, and back in December of 2017, during this post game, we were talking about Bitcoin when it was trading around 17,000. And one of the things I was highlighting when we were having the conversation, which we both completely agreed on, was that we've gone to the parabolic phase of the Bitcoin blow off. And while we didn't identify where the price level was going to peak, because we agreed that it could go from 20,000 to 25,000, it was that from a time frame perspective, we were approaching the window from which that blow off will blow off. And that's because the slope of the rise is steepening during that euphoric phase of one of these parabolic blow offs. And inevitably, when Bitcoin reached that blow off phase, it began a very deep and meaningful reversion from the blow off. And I wanted to use that as the base case of understanding what we're seeing in some of these stocks today. So I really wanted to highlight Apple, which we have on page 5. And I drew on those same kind of trend lines. With the slope of each trend line is steepening and steepening. And we're at a stage now where every one of these little surges higher in Apple is tacking on $20 to $30 billion of market cap onto this stock, to the point that if this thing just rips another $100 to the upside, we're talking about a $2 trillion capitalization on the stock. There's a point where gravity is going to take over on Apple. Now, that's not me saying that Apple's not capable of going to 320 or 330 or even 350 for that. It's just we're at the stage very similar where I have an increasing conviction that the blow-off top and the beginning of some sort of reversion of the price will probably be housed here in the month of January. And so it's one of those things that is high on, like I'm watching very closely with my members. And we want to just try to identify when will we see that kind of key turn point in this rise. Also, just on page 6, what I highlighted, a weekly chart of Apple. And on this weekly chart, I just wanted to illustrate just how steep this rise really is. Because back in 2017, 2016, just after the Jamie Dimon bottom, Apple proceeds to rise from like $100 a share to like $240 or $230 or somewhere in that range. I mean, that was essentially like $130, $140 rise, but it took 2.5 years for the stock to make that rise. And it was not that steep of a slope. But what we can see here is that we tacked on over $150 plus on the upside of Apple in pretty much a year. And I just don't think you can't justify by the fundamentals. It's not like the company's expanding its revenues and earnings. I mean, it is certainly doing a very aggressive share buyback. But this kind of rise, it smells like a parabolic blow off is coming. It still can go higher. Listeners, don't misinterpret me that saying that the top is in or something, but definitely this is one of those really steep moments.
Moving on to page 7 and Tesla. Patrick, again, we see the series of trend lines each getting steeper and steeper. What do you see here? Tesla is a stock which, frankly, has never had a viable business plan, as far as I'm concerned. Yet, boy, what a popular stock it is, and look at it go.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, now it surpassed the market capitalization of both General Motors and Ford combined, and it's just gone parabolic, and obviously has a fuel of massive short squeeze covering. I think at its peak, there was like a 30% of the float was short. And so when you squeeze these managers or these traders out of their positions, it just adds the fuel to run this higher. And, you know, the one part, and I should have even mentioned it earlier when we were talking Bitcoin and Apple, but I love that quote from Jim Rogers, where he basically highlighted that during a bubble blow off, that 50% of the rise tends to happen in the last 10% of the time. And it just feels like that even more so for Tesla. I mean, we've basically gone from somewhere around $330, $340 to $500 pretty much in 1 month. Right. And so this type of a rise is getting to that same exponential factor. And this is not whether or not you're a Tesla Q or not. This is about the fact that eventually every stock that rises at this kind of a slope inevitably mean reverts in some way. And the one thing that I would point out is, at least from these bubbles and these parabolic rises that I've studied, I have very rarely, if almost never, seen one that just consolidates at the highs. Almost all of them deeply mean revert the price gains. And so I think that there's going to be some significant volatility in the coming months, even if Tesla first goes to 600.
But of course, we have to put on the caveat that the challenge there is it's very easy to misidentify what's that final push higher. Boy, look at October 17th, whatever that is, that sudden move up. Doesn't that look like the parabolic blow off in the next few days starting to come down? Everybody's saying, okay, that's it. The top is in. And then that was it, what, 320, 325, and then, you know.
Yeah, but that October one was the earnings announcement that had the gap from 250 going up to 350. So that arguably was just actually the match that lit the fuel of short covering, right? So that, even though it looks like a parabolic move, that was one gap on the news. So it really was what started all of this.
Well, it keeps on going. I mean, my point is simply, you can see two or three or four points along the way here where somebody might have said, okay, look, it's starting to roll over. That's it. The top is in. And it turned out that there was another wave still to come and another wave still after that. Might be still another wave to come. But I agree with you. We're talking about a company that, frankly, I don't think has ever been worth more than $20 a share. But that's adding a little bit of my own value bias into this conversation. One way or another, the chart is definitely parabolic. Moving on to our final slide, I think most of our listeners know, Patrick, that the Vancouver Resource Investing Conference, which is a big precious metals and natural resource investing conference in Vancouver, BC, Canada, is coming up on the 19th and 20th of January, Sunday, Monday. That's just over a week away. You're going to be speaking at that event. I'll come back to that subject because I want you to tell our listeners what you're going to be speaking about. But first, you're doing another event before that on Friday, January 17th again, in Vancouver, same city, same location as the VRIC. This is a live trading event. Now, you did one of these once before in conjunction with our Macro Voices live event in Vancouver. I had a chance to visit that one. I know everybody there seemed very excited and gave a whole bunch of our listeners an opportunity to meet one another and talk to each other in the setting of a live trading session, where basically you had your trades on the screen and you were talking to people about what you were doing and working through the market during a live session. Is that the plan again? And tell people how they can be involved and what the cost is.
So, Eric, we're making it completely free. It's just a great opportunity for me to just show all of our Macro Voice listeners what I do and how I do it. And like we did last year, I load up live trading accounts, put up some really cool trades, assess the markets, and get an opportunity to interact with members over the four-hour window from 8 a.m. out west.
Okay, Patrick, so that one is Friday, January 17th, 8 a.m. until noon. Of course, the timing is because East Coast is where the market is happening and the time zones are different. What about on Sunday and Monday, the 19th and 20th? That's the convention center in Vancouver for VRIC.
Right. So I've got two presentations I'm doing at the resource conference. One is on how to leverage gold like a pro, even if you hate risk. And then the second one I'm doing is how to make big gains without taking big risks on your favorite gold stocks. And so it's going to be a lot of fun. We have a booth out there. And so anyone who wants to come and talk to us about the show, make sure you stop by and say hello.
And bring your crash helmet so you can get on the trampoline and try the gamma flip.
That's right.
This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. Remember to get the ultimate guide to the best investing books ever written at TopTradersUnplugged.com/macro guide. For information on sponsoring Macro Voices, please visit MacroVoices.com/sponsor info. If you haven't already, sign up for your free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit to you is you'll receive our research roundup email each week, which contains links to all of the best content that we could find free on the internet, both presentations associated with our own podcast as well as other free research. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's research roundup.
Well, this week you're going to find a transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the charts we discussed in the postgame. And there's a link to that big gold panel video from the Silver and Gold Summit, and an interesting Bloomberg video with Mike Wilson talking about the liquidity-driven market climb. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share the content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.